the right job. We have to, we can't deny that. On the other hand, you have to have an appreciation for science. For S&S, to appreciate him, and I don't have an appreciation for S&S. So, of course, in my estimation of the three, there's no question that HBL ranked above the other two, and Clark Ashton Smith, I think, definitely rated above REH. Of course, that's a matter of personal opinion. It's purely subjective, and no two people would probably agree on that score. In fact, they might say that those three weren't the best Weird Tale writers at all. They might pick E. Hoffman Price is the best Weird Tale writer, or Seabury Quinney. Seabury Quinney, after all, was the most popular writer in Weird Tales, there was an issue in which there was both a Quinn and an HBL story. Of course, Seabury Quinn, in the readers' poll, took first place, and poor HBL had to be satisfied with second place.
Of course, the three writers were. The three writers were totally different. Smith is essentially a poet. And as a poet, I think that he has quite a bit of merit. As a prose writer, I think he was like a fish out of the water part of the time. Some of his stories are quite skillful, very, very nicely crafted, and some of them, they just read somewhat clumsy. His poetry never reads clumsy. I think foremost, he was a poet. Howard is an action writer. It has been suggested by a German critic in a review, I don't remember which newspaper, but by the way, the criticism that appears in European newspapers quite often is very perceptive. It's not the sort of little summary that we get in the newspapers, if we get any criticism in newspapers. Anyway, the critic speculated that the reason Howard and Edgar Rice Burroughs, for that matter, were more popular with the masses was because they wrote many stories about the same character. So a hero worship could develop. People started thinking of Conan, of Tarzan, etc. Lovecraft did not use a repetitive character, so the stories did not gravitate around the character, but around phenomena, which limited the popular appeal of them. Obviously, Howard has been very influential in the so-called sword and sorcery subgenre, and he has many imitators, and right now he's being exploited in the most shameless manner imaginable. Any piece of fiction that involves a barbarian with sword and a pretty girl carries Howard's name somewhere in order to sell it. It's really sad. Smith is the least appreciated of the three. But I agree with Mr. Shea in placing definitely, as an artist, Smith above Howard. Howard, nevertheless, is not to be dismissed as a totally dishonest or unartistic writer. I think he did put himself into his stories. He maybe wrote his stories a little bit too fast and wrote too many of them. He didn't revise them enough. I don't know what the problem was, but they do sound somewhat more authentic and honest than some of the things that his imitators have perpetrated.
I think, important difference between Lovecraft and the other two writers you refer to is a matter of scale, really. The scale in Lovecraft's work is cosmic. The word cosmic almost feels too small. I don't believe you find quite that cosmicity of scale in the other two. I was going to say before, when we were talking about the fact that the onrush of scientific revelation, the throwing of light into dark corners, would not have chased away the conception of the mythos, for example, because basically science deals only, this sounds a little facetious, but science deals only with the universe, and that's not quite big enough for Lovecraft. And I don't believe you find quite that scale of conceptualization in the other two. Although, you know, I have nothing against the other two. There are stylistic reasons why you can argue for the greatness of Lovecraft, and I don't want to try to make a stylistic comparison. I know that when I teach my Lovecraft course, we look at a number of the classical rhetorical and stylistic devices. I point out examples of things like transferred epithet and chiasmus and paralipsis and all sorts of things that can be found in Lovecraft's writing. To what extent those same devices can be found in the writing of the other two, I'm not certain. But again, it seems to me that the major difference is a matter of scale. Well,
I have one small remark. In terms of Smith's fiction, I think it is almost overwhelmingly influenced by Lovecraft. Smith didn't begin writing fiction on any scale at all until the late 1920s and 30s, and by that time he had read a whole lot of Lovecraft, including many stories in manuscript. And what I sense when I read Smith's fiction is that he is almost trying to duplicate Lovecraft's effects. People have attempted to argue that there was very little influence between Lovecraft and Smith. I think there may have been compared little influence of Smith on Lovecraft, but I think the influence of Lovecraft on Smith is very large in the fiction, though not necessarily in the poetry, because Smith was writing the poetry quite in advance of anything that he encountered in Lovecraft.
Yes.
Would the panel be willing to discuss Brian Lumley's interpretation of Lovecraft?
I don't think Jerk would appreciate that question, but Jerk does not like Brian Lumley whatsoever. Brian Lumley, admittedly, cannot be even called a Lovecraft writer because he is good in his field. In fact, the first time I read a Brian Lumley story, I've forgotten the name of it now, but it was the one about the chorus shell or something, the creature that who transfers places from the quest station changes places with the human, when he becomes a human, he still locks himself in the locker because he still thinks enemies are after him. On the other hand, the human in the crustacean form, of course, the shell didn't appeal to him at all. Who wants to stay in a shell? So he ventures out into the sea, and immediately he gets gobbled up by the voracious predators of the deep. So he didn't have this sense of. Some of other Brian Lumley stories were quite good, but then Brian Lumley suddenly decided that he could write Lovecraft imitations also, and he can't. He gets them published, but they're no good.
He's committed the worst crime that I have ever seen against the Lovecraftian mythology in converting the bubbling chaos of the center of all infinity into the Big Bang.
Let's see. A reduction of an idea. But really, to be honest, when I first read Brian Lumley in The Caller of the Black, I was impressed. He was a lot of promise there. Those short stories were very skillful. They captured atmosphere. And I told myself, now here is one writer who is going to grow. And he has a lot of promise. And then all of a sudden, this absurd, over-explanatory, quasi-science fiction novel, Barrowverse, exploded. And I was very, very saddened by it. And when the next novel appeared, what was it, The Transition, I read about half of that and I just couldn't finish it. It was disturbing to see such a beautiful beginning and a beautiful idea over-explained to the point that it becomes ridiculous. So I think Lumley has skill as a writer, but I'm afraid that he would have made it ideally as a science fiction writer following some traditional science fiction themes. He tried to wed the archetypal type literature with the science fiction literature, and he got an abortion of some sort. Doesn't stand up very well. But that's my own personal opinion or bias.
All I would like to say is that about imitators in general, is my feeling is if they understood and appreciated Lovecraft sufficiently, they would know not to do it. Not to imitate, because there's an unnatural kind of amalgam that usually results, as Derek says, you know, a sort of trying to patch something on, you know, that just doesn't work in the same way Lovecraft's fiction did.
Some years ago, I wrote to Ray Bradbury. I asked him, to what extent, if any, Lovecraft influenced you? And Bradbury's answer was, well, when I was very young and I was starting to write, I was influenced. I wrote a few juvenile things that I later discarded. Because I realized at some point that people like Lovecraft and Poe could do things with words that they alone could do. Someone else trying to mechanically imitate them just makes a fool out of himself. And sure enough, Bradbury went in his own direction, and he's today a very successful writer. Imagine if instead of doing that, he would have tried to mechanically imitate Lovecraft or anyone else. that would have been certainly a waste of a talent. Now, most writers do learn the writing trade by imitating someone. They start out imitating, but it is sad when they are not able to fly on their own. They continue holding on to the umbilical and refuse to let go of it.
My only comment is to quote Samuel Johnson, who said, "Nobody ever became great by imitation."
Yeah.
Other questions, yes.
What does your bibliography have in it? Does it go beyond Chaucer?
Does it go beyond Chaucer? The bibliography contains about 20 times as much material as in Chaucer. What it does not contain, I will tell you this, and this is a grave oversight, I realize, is it does not attempt to figure out which tales of the Cthulhu mythos by other writers other than Lovecraft have been published. I will leave that to Messrs. Weinberg and Berglund, who seem to be very active in that regard. In fact, Berglund told me that he is planning a third edition of the Reader's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos in three volumes. I will leave that whole business to him. I plan to concentrate on Lovecraft, and this is more important, I think, Lovecraft criticism. The only listing of Lovecraft criticism has been the original Chaucer bibliography, which in fact stole that listing from Wetzel, which in fact stole that listing from T.G.L. Cockcroft. So that there's been no listing of Lovecraft criticism since 1953. I have done extensive research in a wide number of publications on Lovecraft. Dirk Mosig has helped extremely on the foreign response, although that's, you know, we are still lacking some of the material, but we have an enormous amount more than was even in the Owings Chaucer bibliography. More, in fact, than you could imagine. The Lovecraft section itself will be detailed very, very carefully. I'm providing full bibliographic description on all the books published by Lovecraft, giving printing, binding, contents, variant editions, and whatnot, and trying to be as complete in Lovecraft's own work and the works which deal about Lovecraft. I'm not bothering with the Cthulhu mythos. I'm not bothering with the Necronomicons which have come out and that sort of peripheral garbage. As it is, it's still very large. My typescript will probably be over 700 pages in length.
Yes, having seen a preliminary draft of the bibliography, conventionally contains, for example, all the anthological appearances in English as well as about 15 other languages. It contains a criticism in a number of different languages, including literally hundreds of reviews appearing in Italian and Spanish and in French and German. In Dutch, Hubert Lampo's articles, for example, are very interesting in Dutch. And it shows the spectrum of response to Lovecraft throughout the world. It will be the kind of document that is really needed if someone is, for instance, trying to write a dissertation and he wants to pursue some lines and see what has been written. Until now, there simply was not a decent reference work. The Owings Chaucer bibliography, I'm sorry to say, has a tremendous number of errors. Some of the books they list do not exist. For instance, when I started collecting foreign Lovecraftiana, for years I tried to find the Danich no Kai that Tokyo Sogensha in Japan supposedly published. And the Sogensha editors kept insisting that we have never published any such animal. And it turned out that it was a book named Kaiki Shosetsu Kesakushu, a great supernatural stories, which contained the story Danich no Kai, the Danish horror. There are so many inaccuracies in it which make the previous bibliography, as well as all the other ones that I've seen before, literally worthless. Yes.
This very knowledgeable panel will surely want you can tell me, what was the Necronomicon published by Alsworth Press?
When was it published?
What was it?
Okay, fortunately I can read Arabic, so I was able to determine immediately that the script is not any particular language. It's a combination of scribbles. Every about 8 pages, the same plates are used. So if you look at any particular page and look at a corner of it, and then you keep turning the pages, suddenly you will find exactly the same page of scribbles.
Then it is just a book.
It is just a bunch of little scribbles. For $30.
In the pseudo-Arabic
The Olswick is just a bunch of scribbles. There have been, of course, a number of other Necronomicons which are all nice jest and fun to have, particularly when a neophyte comes in and you mention, by the way, would you like to see my copy of the Necronomicon? Where did you get that? The nicest one is the one that Schlangenkraft has published in New York.
Yeah.
They have a leather-bound edition with silver edges, and it contains what present as Sumerian and Assyrian rituals, which have some suggestive names like Cthulhu spelled in a different way, and Yog, and all kinds of such names. Incidentally, by the way, there is some basis perhaps for this, not for the Necronomicon, but for using Assyrian and Sumerian words. As David Smith, the author of Oron and several other books that Mr. Shea mentioned, discovered, there is a book by Mercer, which is a list of Assyrian and Sumerian cuneiform symbols, which are transliterated. It's a book with charts of them, which was present at Brown University while Lovecraft was alive in Providence. And David Smith discovered, just going through the symbols, some that transliterated as Cthulhu, Shub, Nagaru, Ib, Yig, a number of the words that Lovecraft used. This may be coincidence, or it may be that Lovecraft used this as a nice source of words, of terms. So whether by design or by coincidence, the Schlangenkraft people, when they printed this Mark Necronomicon, really hit on an inspired source for their alleged text. The other Necronomicon that is being sold now, the Hay, Colin Wilson, etc. Necronomicon, I think has less value. It's somewhat amusing. Colin Wilson's bombastic put-down of Lovecraft here and there is a little bit irritating. Lovecraft is an admittedly bad writer. Why, doesn't say. There are all kinds of intriguing things. In Germany, they have published a Necronomicon, which consists of erotic necrophiliac drawings by a painter named Giger. Now, it's a very impressive art, but you don't want to show it to any visitors out of your house. They'll know you're a pervert of some sort. A translation has been published in France of the Giger Necronomicon, although there are practically no words to translate, and it's just pictures. I almost made a mistake of ordering the French edition until my French correspondent said it cost about $80. Do you want it? It has about 50 words translated. Forget it. But this has no connection with Lovecraft's work. In the case of Giger's Necronomicon, I think he just tried to capitalize, strangely enough, on Lovecraft's name in Europe. Lovecraft is much better known in Europe than he is in this country. The same thing is true of South America. A Buenos Aires newspaper once used the entire Sunday supplement, literary supplement, about 12 pages, with Lovecraft articles and pictures and translations of letters. And it just a daily newspaper. The man on the street in Buenos Aires, if you ask him, ¿Usted sabe quién es H.P. Lovecraft? He's probably going to tell you, oh, yes. Some recognition. You ask the average man on the street in New York, who was H.P. Lovecraft? Love? The craft of what? Of course, in Nebraska, where I'm teaching now, I had the experience of discovering that no one had the faintest idea, except, fortunately, the dean of the college, which ensured our coexistence. Any other questions or comments? Did you have one question? No. Okay.
I suppose everybody has heard of the famous Toronto shop called the Lovecraft Shop, which deals nothing but pornography and love objects.
The issue is I'm curious catalogs. Yes.
One question. Ray Zorn, the Lovecraft collector, the early fanzine that he put out, he has a question. He was wondering where the typescript or the letter that Lovecraft was writing on his illness has been dying for his doctor.
This has been found. R. Alain Everts, who is one of the main biographical researchers in Lovecraft, has actually located Lovecraft's so-called death diary. And I have not seen it. I have not seen a copy of it.
Randy read it to us at one Mad Cons.
Is it not in the Wisconsin Historical Society?
Yes.
Yes.
It was. I don't know how it got into the August Derleth papers, but it got there, and now the Derleth papers are at Wisconsin, and that's where the diary is. Although I believe the Derleth collection, is now closed.
For very good reason.
You may be able to see the collection, but you cannot Xerox or do anything of the kind. That's in Madison, Wisconsin.
But it is a myth that Lovecraft, until this very last moment, was taking notes for his doctor. He was too weak to hold a pencil for the last few days. But he did apparently take some record of his symptoms or something. Apparently his approach, his outlook towards death was a very objective and dispassionate one. No fear, no metaphysical preoccupations, just looking at it as a very natural phenomenon, accepting it. It was pretty consistent there. There was no last minute doubt or repentance or distress of some sort. Any other comments or questions from the audience? Yes.
Would the panel comment on Lovecraft's literary stature as compared to
Poe? Say it again.
Comment on Lovecraft's literary stature as compared to Poe.
Again, another apples and bananas comparison. As Frank Balnablanc put it very nicely in his Dreamer, Poe and Lovecraft are each great in his own way.
I do not mean to compare their works. I mean, Poe was a recognized great writer. Is Lovecraft attaining that stature in literature in general?
I think he will eventually surpass perhaps Poe in terms of academic recognition. Look at the case of Poe. Poe, after his death, was not recognized. Baudelaire had to translate him into French. The French critics discovered them, and then the American critics suddenly realized, hey, he's ours, and then they became aware of him. The foreign recognition of Lovecraft is miles ahead of the American recognition. For instance, last year there was an international symposium on H.P. Lovecraft in Italy. I was fortunate enough to be selected to participate as the American representative. They paid my way all the way to Trieste to address an audience of journalists and critics. Among the people who participated and presented papers on Lovecraft was, for instance, Emilio Cervadillo, who is probably Europe's foremost authority on psychoanalysis, 75-year-old Professor Cervadillo, and a number of equally reputable and important critics. The Italian press covered the event nationally. And the same thing is true to some extent in France. In Spain, we have a lot of fascinating serious criticism by such people as Rafael Llopis, recognized psychiatrist again, and not papers in the sense of trying to make Lovecraft some kind of weird neurotic or the sort of absurd nonsense that we get in lieu of criticism in this country quite often. I see you're itching to make a comment, sir.
The whole problem of recognition of Lovecraft in this country, I think, revolves around the problem that Americans in general and academicians also do not regard fantasy fiction as a serious outlet of literature. They somehow regard it as sort of a cultist sort of thing, and somehow it is not up to the level of mainstream, quote unquote, mainstream fiction. This feeling is not evidenced in Europe, particularly in France, as I have encountered. As Frank Balnablanc remarked in Dreamer on the Night Side, the French feel that fantasy fiction is one of the highest outlets of literature. They call it the fantastique, an untranslatable word. And therefore, we have doctoral dissertations being written in French, a whole lot of them, although only one has been completed at the date, and that's Maurice Levy's Lovecraft, Ou du Fantastique, which, incidentally, I've translated into English. I will try to get that published sometime or other. But Americans have looked down upon fantasy. They don't see how any sort of truths about human life and the human condition can be expressed through fantasy. And that is preventing a lot of recognition. Poe has had to struggle incredibly to gain any sort of recognition. So has Beers. even now they're not quite fitting into the American literary scene. And Lovecraft is obviously facing the same difficulty. Whether these attitudes will change in America is rather debatable. You notice that among mainstream fiction, certain tendencies in used in fantasy literature are sort of creeping in. You might notice the writers called the black humorists, like Vonnegut, who has read Lovecraft and who thinks highly of Lovecraft, and people like Ken Kesey, who mingle horrific or gruesome events or scenes into their quote-unquote mainstream works. These are becoming recognized. So it is to be hoped that the that what Lovecraft called the purveyors of cosmic fear in its purest sense, that is fantasy fiction, will equally attain this recognition eventually. And as I say, there are many signs that Lovecraft is doing exactly that around the world.
Let me add, first just one thing, a couple of times now, Frank Long's book, Dreamer on the Night Side, has been referred to. Certainly, if you're interested in Lovecraft and you haven't read that, it's a very, very, very important little book. I say little book, it is physically small, but conceptually large. It's a very, very important book about Lovecraft. My own feeling and expectation is that Lovecraft will attain a great deal of literary stature. I think will become generally known in this country as a great writer for stylistic reasons. That recognition has been very slow coming. It's a complex kind of thing to try to account for that. But frankly, I, in my own course on Lovecraft, I find myself pointing out lots and lots of beautiful metaphor, for example, in his work. I would argue that some of the finest metaphor in the English language exists in certain Lovecraft stories. And I believe that kind of stylistic raising of the man to, you know, a stature of high critical acceptance will take place. How long that will take to happen, I have no idea. But again, wait and see. I think it will. I think it will happen.
It's also a bias among mainstream critics that a serious work of literature must deal with some human problem and situation. It's not just the old view that you have to uplift the reader. It's that you have to address yourself to hunger or poverty or sex or some human problem or situation. Lovecraft obviously does not write in order to try to solve a human situation or problem of that sort. As long as there is a bias that says anything that does not address itself to such social problems cannot be regarded seriously, we will have a block. But I think, like Professor Burleson says, that eventually Lovecraft will probably be recognized as perhaps one of the most important American writers of the 20th century. In the opinion of some European critics, the most important American writer of the 20th century. Whether that judgment will be upheld, is only time can tell.
I think that the objection most critics have is the thing that Don seems to appreciate the most is Lovecraft's style, which it depends. It's a matter of taste. You either acquired taste. You either like olives or you don't. And so, but Lovecraft's style, of course, it goes back primarily to the 18th century, and to the modern day reader, it sometimes seems very slow, and it's too full of long words. They make fun of words like Eldridge, which of course aren't used today, and they always accuse Lovecraft falsely of padding his stories, of using two or three adjectives where one would suffice, or maybe no simple adjective at all. Of course, Lovecraft had a purpose for using those adjectives, and maybe his choice of adjectives wasn't quite the best. Hemingway, of course, style was completely different. Whenever he revised a manuscript and happened to run across an adjective, immediately red-penciled, while Lovecraft was just the opposite. Although Lovecraft occasionally wrote sentences in which there's not a single adjective. There's a very beautiful one in the music of Eric Zale. If you read that, you think, sure, it must, and didn't know it was by Lovecraft, you'd think, sure, it must be by Lord Dunsany, or even by Hemingway at his most inspired. It's a very beautiful passage. I think Dirk could probably quote it by heart, because Dirk can quote the passages of Lovecraft at an astounding rate. I never was that well qualified. But the trouble is today, there's a great problem. People can't read. Why Johnny can't read in the name of a book, and they want something that's a comic book style. Lovecraft, of course, can be adapted to comic books, and has been. There's a very beautiful one that from South America. It's by Brescia. How do you pronounce that?
Brescia.
Brescia. He jerks.